At this point, I want for us to answer some naturalistic explanations against the miracles of the Word of God. Skeptics will often give naturalistic explanations or arguments against the miracles of the Bible. First of all, the Genesis creation account is based on earlier mythological versions, according to skeptics. Skeptical scholars, so-called scholars, claim that Genesis 1 and 2 is derived from earlier mythical versions. They'll explain it this way: since Moses was educated in Egypt, he would have known of the Egyptian, Babylonian, and Sumerian accounts of the origin of the universe. So let's have some reasonable biblical responses to that. First of all, though the written accounts of the Babylonians and Sumerians are older than the Genesis account, we're talking about the written record there, they are actually mythological embellishments of the Hebrew version of creation. For example, these Babylonian Sumerian accounts speak of polytheism, not one God, monotheism. In these polytheistic accounts, there's conflict between several finite gods. Also in these accounts, man is the product of the blood of an evil god mixed with clay. So we see here a perversion of the Genesis account. Also in these Babylonian and Sumerian accounts and other pagan accounts of the origins of the universe, the sun, moon, and stars already exist in these pagan creation accounts. Also, as you consider this, Moses was educated in Egypt, according to Acts chapter 7, verse 22. But the Egyptian account of origins has no similarities with Genesis. Parts of the Egyptian account of origins goes this way. The ocean produced an egg. This egg, out of this egg, hatched the sun god, who had four children. There was a rivalry between the children that brought about the creation. So we see no similarities with the Genesis account. So we see that the Egyptian, the Babylonian, the Sumerian accounts, and other accounts of origins are actually perversions or corruptions of the Hebrew account, even though it was not written at that time. Also, as we understand this, 17,000 clay tablets discovered at Ebla predate the Babylonian account by 600 years. And in some of those clay tablets, there's an account of creation that's very similar to the Genesis account. So I believe that the Genesis creation account is accurate as it's presented in the Word of God. Also, another naturalistic explanation I want to answer: the flood account is based on mythical flood stories. The flood account is based on mythical flood stories. So-called Bible scholars assume that the Genesis account of the flood is derived from ancient Babylonian and Sumerian mythical accounts of the flood. Also, they claim that the many flood stories around the world are local floods, not a global event. For example, the Greeks, the Hindus, the Chinese, the Hawaiians. I believe there's hundreds of flood stories around the world. But the skeptics will say that these are local floods, not a global event. All right, so let's look at some reasonable biblical answers to those skeptical arguments. Most other flood stories contain embellishments that indicate corruption of the original account of the Hebrews, the account that we have found written in the book of Genesis. Only the Genesis account gives the year of the flood and the chronology of Noah. Genesis 5 gives us the opportunity to figure the approximate date of the flood after creation. Also, the Babylonian ship, according to the Babylonian account of the flood, was cubical and would not have saved anyone from a raging flood. Let's see what the biblical account says. Genesis chapter 6. Genesis chapter 6, verses 14 through 16. Make thee an ark of gopher wood. Rooms shalt thou make in the ark, and shalt pitch it within and without with pitch. And this is the fashion which thou shalt make it of. The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits, the breadth of it 50 cubits, and the height of it 30 cubits. Notice here the measurements, the ratio that's given here, 30 by 5 by 3. Many say that is the best design to withstand stormy seas. So we see the cubical Babylonian ship would not have saved anyone in a raging flood. The pagan flood stories only state 7 days of rainfall, not enough time for the devastation of the earth, and also not enough water to cover the mountains. Genesis chapter 7. Again, I want for us to expose these corrupted accounts with the Word of God. Genesis chapter 7, verses 17 and following. And the flood was 40 days upon the earth, and the waters increased, and bare up the ark, and it was lift up above the earth. And the waters prevailed, and were increased greatly upon the earth, and the ark went upon the face of the waters. And the waters prevailed exceedingly upon the earth, and all the high hills that were under the whole heaven were covered. Notice the reference here to a global flood under the whole heaven. 15 cubits upward did the waters prevail. Some say that's 22 feet, depending on how long a cubit was, according to the scriptural standard. The mountains were covered. Notice the mountains were covered. And all flesh died that moved upon the earth, both of fowl and of cattle and of beast, and of every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth, and every man. All in whose nostrils was the breath of life, and of all that was in the dry land died. I believe this is how we received the fossil record. In fact, Ken Ham says, billions of dead things buried in rock layers laid down by water all over the earth. The fossil record supports the flood account of Genesis. Pagan accounts of the flood claim that the floodwaters subsided in one day, which is an impossibility. The pagan flood stories exalt the hero as immortal. The Bible openly reveals Noah's sin. Genesis chapter 9, verse 20. And Noah began to be an husbandman, and he planted a vineyard, and he drank of the wine and was drunken, and he was uncovered within his tent. And then we see the story here of Ham and his grandson Canaan. But here we see that the Bible account is not presenting Noah as immortal, unlike the pagan flood stories. There is geological evidence worldwide in support of the global flood. For example, sea life fossils on the tops of mountains. How did they get there if it was not a global flood? Also, how do you explain pillow lava on Mount Ararat? Mount Ararat, I believe it's at 17,000 feet, has pillow lava. Pillow lava is formed underwater. So again, I believe the evidence points to the fact that the Genesis account is accurate. Third, consider also the plagues of Egypt, they say, were caused by natural phenomenon. Climatologists have supposedly discovered the true scenario as to the cause of the plagues. Listen to this quote here. This is taken from the Friday Church News Notes, April 2, 2012. It's a quote from scientists find naturalistic answers for biblical plagues. A drought produced a sort of red tide to the River Nile. The same bacterium that brought this phenomenon produced an abundance of frogs, which then resulted in an increase in flies and lice. That resulted in diseased livestock and boils. Then a volcano eruption brought hail, locusts, and darkness. Finally, a fungus that poisoned the grain supplies killed the firstborn males. Why just them, you ask? Because the male firstborn would have had first pickings and so been first to fall victim. Again, that's a quote from Friday Church News Notes, April 2, 2012. Let me give you a reasonable biblical answer for this. It is easier to believe that God sent these plagues upon Egypt than to accept the fact that 10 disasters happened simultaneously just out of coincidence. Exodus chapter 3, verses 19 and 20. Exodus chapter 3, verses 19 and 20. As we even consider this passage, God is predicting these plagues upon Egypt. Exodus chapter 3, verses 19 and 20. And I am sure that the king of Egypt will not let you go, no, not by a mighty hand. And I will stretch out my hand and smite Egypt with all my wonders, which I will do in the midst thereof. And after that, he will let you go. Number four, according to Exodus 14, they say that the Red Sea should be the Reed Sea. They say that this is a mistranslation in the Bible. The Red Sea should actually be the Reed Sea. They claim that this is not a miraculous parting of the water, the Red Sea, to allow the Israelites to cross on dry ground. Rather, instead, Israel crossed over in shallow water in the reeds. Let me give you a reasonable biblical answer to this. How does one explain the sudden end of Israel's slavery in Egypt? Now, that slavery is a proven fact of history. But how also does one explain the drowning of the entire Egyptian army in the reeds? Exodus chapter 15. Exodus chapter 15, verses 1 and following. I believe, in essence, that's a greater miracle than God causing the Red Sea to part so that they could cross on dry land. Exodus chapter 15, verse 1. Then sang Moses and the children of Israel this song unto the Lord, and spake, saying, I will sing unto the Lord, for he hath triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider hath he thrown into the sea. The Lord is my strength and song. He has become my salvation. He is my God. And I will prepare him in a habitation, my father's God, and I will exalt him. The Lord is a man of war. The Lord is his name. Pharaoh's chariots and his host hath he cast into the sea. The sea, his chosen captains also are drowned in the Red Sea. The depths have covered them. They sank into the bottom as a stone. And again, this goes on to explain this. Also, Nehemiah chapter 9 refers to this as well. How do you explain the drowning of the entire Egyptian army in the reeds when the Israelites passed over without harm? Number 5, many doubt the supernatural provision of manna in the wilderness. Many botanists believe that the manna was either a secretion from trees and bushes or a seed, even as the Bible refers to a coriander seed. The word manna itself means, what is it? So in other words, according to this skeptical answer, this skeptical explanation of the manna in the wilderness, the Israelites were not from this area and were not familiar with this secretion or seed. Let me give you some answers to this biblically and according to reason. How is there enough manna to feed millions of people 6 days each week for 40 years at various locations throughout the wilderness? By the way, something else with that in mind, why did it not drop on the Sabbath? Exodus chapter 16, verse 35. Exodus chapter 16, verse 35. It says, and the children of Israel did eat manna 40 years until they came to a land inhabited. They did eat manna until they came unto the borders of the land of Canaan. With that said, consider also Joshua chapter 5 and verse 12, how it suddenly ended once they were in the land of Canaan. Joshua chapter 5 and verse 12. Notice here it says, and the manna ceased on the morrow after they had eaten of the old corn of the land. Neither had the children of Israel manna any more, but they did eat of the fruit of the land of Canaan that year. So why was this food supply suddenly discontinued when they entered the land of Canaan? Number 6. Skeptics doubt the walls of Jericho fell supernaturally. Skeptics doubt that the walls of Jericho fell supernaturally. Some suggest that the walls of Jericho fell because of earthquakes in the area. Dozens of structures, they say, in several Bronze Age cities appear to have collapsed simultaneously. In 1927, an earthquake occurred that had an epicenter 9 miles north of Jericho. Let me give you some reasonable biblical answers to this. Just because there is seismic activity in modern times does not prove earthquakes 3,000 years ago. Let me also ask a question. How did Israel plan for an earthquake to conquer Jericho? How did they plan this earthquake in order to conquer the city? Notice with me Joshua chapter 2. Joshua chapter 2 and verse 18. Behold, when we come into the land, thou shalt bind this line of scarlet thread in the window, which thou didst let us down by. And thou shalt bring thy father and thy mother and thy brethren and all thy father's household home unto thee. And it shall be that whosoever shall go out of the doors of thy house into the street, his blood shall be upon his head, and we will be guiltless. And whosoever shall be with thee in the house, his blood shall be on our head if any hand be upon him. Consider also chapter 6, chapter 6, verses 1 through 5. Again, I'm asking the question, how did Israel plan for an earthquake to conquer the city? Joshua chapter 6, verse 1. Now Jericho was straitly shut up because of the children of Israel. None went out and none came in. And the Lord said unto Joshua, see, I have given into thine hand Jericho and the king thereof and the mighty men of valor. And ye shall compass the city, all ye men of war, and go round about the city once. Thus shalt thou do 6 days. And 7 priests shall bear before the ark 7 trumpets of ram's horns. The 7th day ye shall compass the city 7 times, and the priests shall blow with the trumpets. And it shall come to pass that when they make a long blast with the ram's horn, and when ye hear the sound of the trumpet, all the people shall shout with a great shout. and the wall of the city shall fall down flat, and the people shall ascend up every man straight before him. How did Israel time the conquering of the city by way of this earthquake? An earthquake would also cause the walls to crumble. Joshua chapter 6 and verse 5, and then also verse 20, tells us that the wall fell flat. Notice verse 20 of Joshua chapter 6. So the people shouted when the priest blew with the trumpets. And it came to pass when the people heard the sound of the trumpet, and the people shouted with a great shout, that the wall fell down flat, so that the people went up into the city, every man straight before him, and they took the city. An earthquake would cause these walls to crumble, not to fall flat. Now, the wall around Jericho, they estimate, was probably 10 to 25 feet wide at its base. Listen to this statement about the walls of this period of history. The fortification techniques developed in the Middle Bronze period included steep earthen slopes, some reaching 50 feet, at the foundation of the walls, and a ditch around the outside dug to bedrock. These features would both hamper the approach of siege machines and prevent tunneling. Now, Rahab's house also, I point out and remind you, was on the wall, according to Joshua chapter 2 and verse 15. How does an earthquake single out one house on the wall? I believe the skeptical arguments against the walls of Jericho falling flat, I believe, fall flat. Number 7. The sundial of Ahaz went back 10 degrees, according to Isaiah chapter 38. According to Isaiah 38, verse 8, the sundial of Ahaz went back 10 degrees. Now, skeptics argue that the reading of a sundial can be changed by cloud covering. I want you to notice with me 2 Kings chapter 20. Let me point out here some biblical answers to this. Isaiah reports that Hezekiah was sick unto death, according to Isaiah 38, verse 1. Now, as we see here in 2 Kings chapter 20 and verse 1, we see also the reference here to this. In those days was Hezekiah sick unto death, and the prophet Isaiah, the son of Amoz, came to him and said unto him, Thus saith the Lord, set thine house in order, for thou shalt die and not live. That's the context that we must understand here. Hezekiah requested a sign or a confirmation that he would be healed. Let's read the context of this. Verse 2. Then he turned his face to the wall and prayed unto the Lord, saying, I beseech thee, O Lord, remember now how I have walked before thee in truth and with a perfect heart, and have done that which is good in thy sight. And Hezekiah wept sore. And it came to pass, afore Isaiah was gone out into the middle court, that the word of the Lord came to him, saying, Turn again and tell Hezekiah, the captain of my people, Thus saith the Lord, the God of David, thy father, I have heard thy prayer, I have seen thy tears, and behold, I will heal thee. On the third day thou shalt go up into the house of the Lord. And I will add unto thy days 15 years, and I will deliver thee and this city out of the hand of the king of Assyria. And I will defend this city for mine own sake, and for my servant David's sake. And Isaiah said, Take a lump of figs. And they took and laid it on the boil, and he recovered. Now notice here verse 8. And Hezekiah said unto Isaiah, What shall be the sign, again, or the confirmation, that the Lord will heal me, and that I shall go up into the house of the Lord the third day? He's asking for a confirmation that he will be healed. And Isaiah said, This sign shalt thou have of the Lord, that the Lord will do the thing that he hath spoken. Now notice here, Isaiah asks a question. Shall the shadow go forward 10 degrees or go back 10 degrees? And Hezekiah answered, It is a light thing for the shadow to go down 10 degrees. Nay, but let the shadow return backward 10 degrees. Now some suggest that this is 40 minutes of time. And Isaiah the prophet cried unto the Lord, and he brought the shadow 10 degrees backward by which it had gone down in the dial of Ahaz. Let me point out something here. The prophet Isaiah asked King Hezekiah to choose, to make a choice, if he wanted the dial to go forward or back 10 degrees. How can one choose how cloud cover will affect a sundial? Number 8, Jonah and the great fish have naturalistic explanations. 4 things had to happen for Jonah to survive inside the whale. First of all, the creature had to be large enough. Second of all, Jonah had to pass over the creature's teeth unmolested. Jonah had to avoid the digestive juices of the whale's stomach. And he had to have enough oxygen to survive 3 days. Let me give you some reasonable biblical answers for these skeptical arguments. First of all, the swallowing of Jonah was not the only miracle mentioned in this account. For example, notice with me, Jonah chapter 1, verses 15 and 16. So they took up Jonah and cast him forth into the sea, and the sea ceased from her raging. Then the men feared the Lord exceedingly and offered a sacrifice unto the Lord and made vows. I believe that's indication here that there was an immediate calm because they are beginning to worship Jehovah, not their false gods. Also, God prepared the great fish for Jonah. God was directly involved in this event. So ultimately, this is an attack on God if the skeptic is going to deny that this took place. It says in Jonah 1 verse 17, "Now the Lord had prepared a great fish to swallow up Jonah, and Jonah was in the belly of the fish 3 days and 3 nights." Also, a large sperm whale can easily swallow lumps of food 8 feet in diameter. So a large whale is able to swallow a man. Something changed also in Jonah's rebellious spirit. And he gave the reason in chapter 2. Notice it says in Jonah chapter 2, "Then Jonah prayed unto the Lord his God out of the fish's belly, and said, I cried by reason of mine affliction unto the Lord, and he heard me. Out of the belly of hell cried I, and thou heardest my voice. For thou hast cast me into the deep, in the midst of the seas." Notice here the description that he has here of his time in the belly of this great fish. "And the floods compassed me about, all thy billows and thy waves passed over me. Then I said, I am cast out of thy sight, yet I will look again toward thy holy temple. The waters compassed me about, even to the soul. The depth closed me round about. The weeds were wrapped around my head." He was entangled by seaweed. "I went down to the bottoms of the mountains. The earth with her bars was about me forever. Yet hast thou brought up my life from corruption, O Lord my God. When my soul fainted within me, I remembered the Lord. And my prayer came in unto thee, into thine holy temple. They that observe lying vanities forsake their own mercy. But I will sacrifice unto thee with the voice of thanksgiving. I will pay that I have vowed, salvation is of the Lord. And the Lord spake unto the fish, and it vomited out Jonah upon the dry land." So here we see that there was a radical change. Even as we look at chapter 3, God is the God of second chances. "And the word of the Lord came unto Jonah the second time, saying, Arise, go unto Nineveh, that great city, and preach unto it the preaching that I bid thee. So Jonah arose and went unto Nineveh according to the word of the Lord." Now Nineveh was an exceeding great city of 3 days' journey. So we see a radical change in Jonah's rebellious spirit, and he gave the reason in this passage. Now Jesus referred to the account of Jonah as fact, and his Jewish hearers did not deny the credibility of the story. For example, notice with me Matthew chapter 12. Matthew chapter 12. Here we see Jesus Christ referring to Jonah, the account of the Old Testament, as literal history. "Then certain of the scribes and the Pharisees answered, saying, Master, we would see a sign from thee. But he answered and said unto them, An evil and adulterous generation seeketh after a sign. And there shall no sign be given to it, but the sign of the prophet Jonas. For as Jonas was 3 days and 3 nights in the whale's belly, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth. The men of Nineveh shall rise in judgment with this generation and shall condemn it because they repented at the preaching of Jonas. And behold, a greater than Jonas is here." In some ways, I believe the men of Nineveh are going to rise up in judgment against the skeptics of our day because they deny what Jesus Christ said. Chapter 16 and verse 4. Chapter 16 and verse 4. "A wicked and adulterous generation seeketh after a sign, and there shall no sign be given unto it, but the sign of the prophet Jonas. And he left them and departed." So again, we see here that Jesus refers to the account of Jonah as fact. In other words, skeptics would call Jesus Christ a liar. That's a serious accusation. Number 9, the miracle of the great catch of fish has a natural explanation. John chapter 21. John chapter 21, this great catch of fish after the resurrection. John 21, verses 3 through 6. Simon Peter saith unto them, I go a-fishing. They say unto him, we also go with thee. They went forth and entered into a ship immediately, and that night they caught nothing. But when the morning was now come, Jesus stood on the shore, but the disciples knew not that it was Jesus. Then Jesus saith unto them, children, have ye any meat? They answered him, no. He said unto them, cast the net on the right side of the ship, and ye shall find. They cast therefore, and now they were not able to draw it for the multitude of fishes. Now some suggest that fish cluster around saline springs on the floor of the Sea of Galilee. Someone who is aware of these springs would know the best place to fish. Let me give you reasonable biblical answers for that. Jesus was a carpenter by trade. He was trained as a carpenter. And he was telling experienced fishermen where to fish. That does not sound reasonable. The discovery of saline springs was made almost 2,000 years after Christ lived around the Sea of Galilee. But let me point out here, though, that Jesus, according to this account, did not tell the disciples to fish in another location. Instead, he told them to fish from another side of the boat. A big difference there. Number 10. Let's answer another skeptical argument on miracles. Jesus did not literally feed 4,000 and 5,000 people. According to Matthew chapter 14, verse 21, there were 5,000 men besides women and children. So it's not even 4,000 and 5,000 people according to the gospel accounts. Also, Matthew chapter 15, verse 38, it says 4,000 men plus women and children. So we're speaking of possibly 20,000 people or more that Jesus Christ fed. Now, skeptics claim that these accounts are given as examples of everyone sharing what food they had until everyone had something to eat. All right, so let's answer this reasonably from the Word of God. Now, the multitudes were following Jesus because of his miracles. We've already seen this in John chapter 6 and verse 2. They were following Jesus Christ because of the miracles that they saw. The great multitude followed him because they saw his miracles, which he did on them that were diseased. They were following because of the miracles that they observed. They were eyewitnesses of his miracles. Now, if everyone simply shared what food they already had, why did they try to forcibly make him a king according to this passage? Notice verse 14 and 15. Then those men, when they had seen the miracle that Jesus did, said, this is of a truth that prophet that should come into the world. When Jesus therefore perceived that they would come and take him by force to make him a king, he departed again into a mountain himself alone. Why were they wanting to forcibly make him a king? You see, they were wanting a king that could supply all of their needs. Now, it says here in these accounts, in the Gospels, only one boy had a lunch, not the whole multitude. In fact, we're close here. Notice John chapter 6 and verse 9. There is a lad here which hath 5 barley loaves and 2 small fishes, but what are they among so many? We see in this passage and in this context that the disciples searched through the multitudes and they only found one boy who had a lunch. Now, if everyone had their own lunch, why was Jesus concerned with giving them food, giving them bread? It says in these gospel accounts that he had compassion on the multitudes because they were faint, that they would not have enough strength to return into the cities to buy food. How is there more than 12 times as much food when as when they began? It says that they gathered up 12 baskets full in the feeding of the 5,000 men. So how was there more than 12 times as much food as when they began? Jesus only blessed the 5 loaves and 2 fishes, not an entire carry-in dinner. There's no indication in these gospel accounts that he blessed all the food that they had shared collectively. Jesus gave specific amounts when he was dealing with the disciples after these accounts. Notice with me Matthew chapter 16. Matthew 16 verse 9. Do ye not yet understand, neither remember the 5 loaves of the 5,000 and how many baskets ye took up? Neither the 7 loaves of the 4,000 and how many baskets ye took up? So we see here that Jesus Christ gave the specific amounts later on in dealing with the disciples. 20,000 people, 5,000 men plus women and children, walking to a deserted place, a desert place, would not have been carrying large amounts of food. We're talking about days that they were following Jesus Christ. They would not have had large amounts of food with them. Number 11, many skeptics will say that there are rational explanations for Jesus walking on the water. Listen to me, Matthew chapter 14. Matthew chapter 14, verses 22 and following. As it says here in verse 22, "And straightway Jesus constrained his disciples to get into a ship and to go before him unto the other side, while he sent the multitudes away. And when he had sent the multitudes away, he went up into a mountain apart to pray. And when the evening was come, he was there alone. But the ship was now in the midst of the sea, tossed with waves, for the wind was contrary. And in the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went unto them, walking on the sea. And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, It is a spirit, and they cried out for fear. But straightway Jesus spake unto them, saying, Be of good cheer, it is I, be not afraid. And Peter answered him and said, Lord, if it be thou, bid me come unto thee on the water. And he said, Come. And when Peter was come down out of the ship, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. But when he saw the wind boisterous, he was afraid. And beginning to sink, he cried, saying, Lord, save me. And immediately Jesus stretched forth his hand and caught him and said unto him, O thou of little faith, wherefore didst thou doubt? And when they were come into the ship, the wind ceased." I believe there's another miracle there. We'll talk about that. Then they that were in the ship came and worshipped him, saying of a truth, Thou art the Son of God. Let's answer this skeptical claim. Skeptics claim that Jesus did not literally walk on water. As he walked on the misty shore, it only appeared that he was walking on the water. So let's give reasonable biblical answers for the skeptics. The Bible gives a clear statement that the ship was in the midst of the sea. It says in Matthew 14, verse 24, "But the ship was now in the midst of the sea, tossed with waves." With that said, notice, how can a ship be tossed by waves in shallow water to the point of causing fear in experienced sailors? Let me remind you that these are experienced sailors. They had experienced storms on the sea before. So how is it causing fear in their hearts? Experienced fishermen would know if they were close to the shore or not. In fact, John 6, verse 19 speaks of 25 to 30 furlongs, about 4 miles. I don't believe experienced fishermen would be 4 miles off on their estimation. Something else with that, Peter would have known whether he was walking on water or on the sand. Walking on the water, as I pointed out here, was not the only miracle that's mentioned in this passage. We see here that the wind ceased immediately, and also the ship was immediately at the land, according to John chapter 6 and verse 21. A gradual calming of the sea would not have invoked worship, even as we see in these passages in the Gospels. Now, let me address historical relativism. I believe historical relativism is one of the root causes of explaining away the miracles of the Bible. Some historians believe that we must rewrite history by reconstructing the past on the basis of the present. That's called revisionist history. By the way, our American textbooks have been going through revisionist history for quite some time as well. Historians must begin with the Bible as the foundation for a proper understanding of history. I believe that with all my heart. Why is it that so many secular historians are going off into strange things regarding history? It's because they're not starting with the Bible as the source or as the foundation for a proper understanding of history. Historians often have direct access to information about the past through the evidence of archaeology. I believe archaeology gives us direct access to the past to give us an understanding of history. If the Bible has historical errors regarding miracles, then it cannot be trusted in spiritual matters. That's a serious problem because then it affects our salvation. If there is no evidence verifying the miracles of the Bible, then Christianity lapses into mythology just like other religions. And that is exactly what the skeptic wants.